Demolition is underway, clearing room for the South Mountain Freeway Loop 202. And the walls are tumbling down.
Of course, I know they understood that it was going to be happening, okay? But even so, it's, you know, you didn't think it was really going to happen until the next thing you know, here they are knocking the houses down.
I'm Mark Brody. Also today on the show, are different plans to increase school funding competing with or complementing each other? Building a spacecraft to map water and ice on the moon, a chef from New Orleans begins his post-Katrina life in the desert, and the risks of riding hundreds of miles on horseback across Mongolia.
Before every horse, you just kind of cross your fingers that it's not going to, you know, be a demon and throw you into some rocks and then ditch you 20 miles out from the next station.
Plus shipping ice to Antarctica, and we take in the symphony. That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. The Arizona Department of Transportation this morning demolished the first house in the path of the Loop 202 South Mountain Extension Project. KJZZ's Carrie Young was there and joins me. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Mark.
So what was going on?
Well, demolition started early today. By 7:30 this morning, an earth mover was already taking its first pass at the house located in the Goldman Ranch neighborhood in Ahwatukee. It removed several windows in that first pass and at least half of a back room. This neighborhood is mostly empty now. There are still a few people living there, though. Once the process started today, a small crowd gathered to watch. It was mostly reporters, but a few people from surrounding neighborhoods did stop by as well, and their reactions were mixed. Scott Herman lives a few miles west of the demolition site. He wasn't happy about the project, but was pretty resigned to the fact that it is moving ahead. His main concern is pollution and the freeway's environmental impacts.
I mean, I just heard today that they figure 135,000 cars are going to be driving on this on a daily basis. I mean, listen to how quiet it is. Other than that destruction, that's going away permanently, and nobody cares.
Window shattering and stucco crumbling is part of what broke that quiet today. But Carrie Alter, who lives about 6 miles away from the site, says he understands that sacrifices have been made for this project to move forward. Overall, though, he thinks it's a good thing for the community.
For the whole area, I think eventually it will relieve traffic up and down Chandler Boulevard and Ray Road.
Steve Breeze, however, lives a mile or so south of the neighborhood. He was decidedly less pleased about the demolition. He says the whole situation is a shame for those who had to leave their homes.
I mean, these houses aren't that old. The neighborhood hasn't been here that long, and then all of a sudden, of course, I know they understood that it was going to be happening, okay? But even so, it's, you know, you didn't think it was really going to happen until the next thing you know, here they are knocking the houses down.
There are about 70 homes in this neighborhood that ADOT plans to demolish. 20 still need to be acquired. In all, though, 400 buildings are in the path of this planned freeway that will connect I-10 in the West Valley to another stretch of the interstate near Chandler, where I was.
So, Carrie, what was happening to the stuff that was inside the house? Was it being taken out? Was it being demolished with the rest of the house?
So, yes and no. Some things were getting demolished, but yesterday, contractors did get the chance to go through the house and take out things like air conditioning units, ranges, dishwashers, and that kind of thing. Those, I was told, they're supposed to be resold then.
And what's next?
Well, what's next? Officials say construction is supposed to begin after the demolition phase. That's expected in 2016. The freeway is supposed to be opening to traffic, though. They're estimating in late 2019 or early 2020.
KJZZ's Carrie Young. Carrie, thanks.
Thank you.
It's been a busy week in the area of school funding in Arizona. On Tuesday, talks on the effort to get schools more than $1 billion they say the state owes them broke down. Not long after that announcement, House Speaker David Gowan and Senate President Andy Biggs announced a plan they say would get up to $5 billion more into classrooms over the next decade. Joining me to talk about all of this is State Senate reporter Ben Giles with the Arizona Capital Times. Hi, Ben.
Hi.
So why did the talks break down, and what led to that?
Well, we won't actually know that because a judge has barred anyone who was in those mediation discussions from talking about what was on the table, what was discussed. But what we can gather is that the legislature didn't want to pay as much as the schools are hoping to get out of them, which is could be nearly $2 billion in funding for K-12 education. So now we've got two parts to the case. We've got a payment going forward, which a judge has already ruled that the legislature owes about $330 million to schools every year going forward. But there's a separate part to the case about back pay for the inflation that courts have ruled the legislature didn't provide the schools for a number of years, and that totals, as of right now, roughly $1.3 billion potentially. So there's a lot of money at stake, and that's basically why mediation fell through, because there couldn't be common ground found. Nobody could find a number of here's how much this, the legislature is willing to pay, and the schools would be okay with that.
So checking the timestamps, it seemed like very quickly after word came out that the talks had broken down, we all got emails from House Speaker David Gowan and Senate President Andy Biggs that they had a proposal to get more money into the classroom. What would that plan do?
That would potentially, they're saying, provide about $5 billion over the next 10 years. And it does it in a number of ways. It incorporates somehow Governor Doug Ducey's proposal to use funds from the state land trust, a couple billion dollars there, to provide more money to schools over 10 years. It would also like to, as lawmakers have tried in the past, raid the First Things First program to provide more funding. And then they're also looking at the baseline funding for education. For the last 2 years, lawmakers have added about $75 million per year to education. And that was sort of a good faith effort, recognizing that, yeah, the court said we do owe the schools more money. Here's what we think we owe them. And obviously that's still being debated in court since mediation fell through. But they'd like to take credit for that going forward. And then they'd also like to take a little bit of this surplus that the state has experienced with revenue collections in fiscal 15. There's about $325 million in cash that the state didn't expect to have. Some of that is ongoing revenues, and the plan from leadership is to take about $100 million of that and start to put it towards schools.
Should we be looking at this plan and the plan that the governor put out a little while back dealing with state trust land? Should we be looking at those as competing plans, complementary plans, something else?
You know, it's hard to tell at this point, because I think from leadership, from Gowan and Biggs, they'd like them to be a package deal. And Doug Ducey was vague in his thoughts on that proposal yesterday when he was talking with reporters. It's hard to tell if the governor is amenable to having his state land trust plan be a part of that. There's suspicion that, no, he wants this dealt with separately. He wants his plan dealt with first, individually, to get that approved, and then take a look at the plan coming from Republican leadership at the legislature.
Ben Giles covers the state Senate for the Arizona Capital Times. Ben, thanks.
Thank you.
Still to come, ASU will be leading a mission to map water ice on the moon.
This mission is really getting at, more specifically than what's been previously done, where is that water ice and how much is there, and I think we're going to be surprised. Absolutely hope we see some surprises with this one.
That's ahead. It's the show. Good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. In Valley traffic, on the 101 southbound in the East Valley, the exit ramp at Southern is restricted. Also watch out for an accident 51 southbound at Northern. We're looking for partly cloudy skies for the rest of the day today with a high of 108. We hit 106 yesterday. 104 is average for today. Partly cloudy skies on the way for tonight. Slight chance of showers. Overnight lows in the mid to upper 80s. It'll be sunny for tomorrow. Partly sunny Saturday as well. Look for a high of 109 tomorrow. 108 on Sunday. 106. 108 tomorrow. And 106 on Sunday. Right now, with relative humidity of 20%, it is 106 degrees at 2:15.
KJZZ is supported by Front Doors News, your connection to Valley philanthropy, culture, luxury, and living. You can open the door to Valley society at frontdoorsnews.com.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Huckenberry.
And I'm Mark Brody. In a world of $100 a barrel oil, there is one set of incentives for making a better oil well. But with oil trading at $40 a barrel, and with some predictions of it trading as low as $20 a barrel by the end of the year, what does that mean, a better oil well?
Reporter Lee Patterson and data journalist Jordan Wirfs-Brock are with Inside Energy. How does innovation in extraction and capture of oil and gas survive in this environment, Lee?
Well, it's a particular type of innovation. We're not talking about groundbreaking technologies that have never been used before. These days, the way we're getting more out of each well is by drilling wells faster. Some companies are drilling wells in half the time that it used to take before oil prices dropped. They're also focusing on their most productive wells. They're looking at the sweet spots, and the sweet spots are the areas that are richest in hydrocarbons. A lot of producers have also started using downhole sensors, which with recent technological innovations can now withstand very, very high heat. And those sensors can provide data to the people up above ground about, you know, what's going on. Halliburton in particular has started using something called a diverting agent, which is a biodegradable chemical that you shoot down into the well, and it sort of seals off some of the fractures so that engineers can better direct the frack to the rocks that are richer in oil and gas.
It's fluid mechanics being applied more efficiently to really push that oil out without losing it in the deep underground shale.
Exactly. And diverting agents are actually a key component of something that's also becoming pretty popular these days, and it's called a refrac. And a refrac is exactly what it sounds like. You shoot chemicals and sand and water down into a well that you've already fracked to get more oil and gas out of the ground. The reason for doing that is because it's cheaper than drilling a new well. So a diverting agent can be really key in that process.
What is the break-even point for these fracked wells? And, you know, because fracking itself is an innovation that really transformed the entire industry over the last 10, 15 years. Do these wells work at $20 a barrel, at $40 a barrel, at $50 a barrel, at $100 a barrel?
That all depends where you are. And the break-even point can vary even within one play. It all depends on where the richest hydrocarbons are. And a lot of other very complicated factors. And that break-even point is really what this is all about.
Some of the data stuff is really scary, Jordan, here, because I've read that you don't get much out of these wells. It's the percentages are like 7, 12% what it comes out of some of these wells.
Right, and the interesting thing is most of that production comes in the first portion of the well's life. So it's going to be operating for 30 years often, but you get a big bump at the beginning, and then the production kind of sloughs off over time. So it's really hard to look at the long-term payback on a well when you have to take that into consideration, too.
And so in many ways, it's because the pressure goes down or the easy stuff goes away, and part of the whole diverting agent is a way of getting more pressure down there to wash the rest of it out.
Well, I think, you know, I think the fact that so much oil and gas is left in the ground, you know, there are a lot of different reasons. It's really hard to know what's happening underground. You know, extraction is a complicated process. And if oil is drawn from a field too quickly or from a bad location or from the wrong kind of well, large amounts can be left behind. And, you know, I've even read estimates that if we deployed all of the current technology on the market in any, you know, any particular reservoir, we would still only be able to get one-third of the oil and gas out from under the ground. And I think that's just, you know, due to technological limitations.
With gas prices the way they are now, is there any incentive for producers to capture all the gas that usually flares out or that often just leaks through pipelines and various other sorts of processing infrastructure?
Ideally, but the complication with that is when gas is flared, it's often because at that particular drill site, there's no infrastructure to transport it. And so it does sound like a cost-saving mechanism, but they would have to build pipelines and compressor stations and all that to be able to monetize that natural gas. So it's complicated.
Now, environmentalists, of course, listening to this conversation would say, well, then, of course, the innovation is conservation. That's the real innovation, and that's what we really should be investing in. And if these things don't work at $40 a barrel or $30 a barrel, it's up to the consumers and for energy companies to really innovate on the conservation side of things. Where does that stand?
Well, so we've talked to several companies, many of which are in Colorado, some are in Texas, that are really focused on environmental innovation in the energy sector. There are companies that are gathering gas that would otherwise just get burned off, which is what we were talking about before. There are some companies experimenting with capturing diesel exhaust and turning that into electricity, but they might have a stronger future later on when oil prices go back up. I mean, I've talked to many of these companies. Business is okay, but it's not booming. The Halliburtons of the world are not calling these guys to say, hey, we want to use your new thermoelectric heat generator to, you know, capture diesel and turn it into electricity. That's just not the kind of investment that the big dogs are making right now.
Does the goalpost move in this volatile environment of oil price fluctuations? In other words, does the data picture of energy production and energy innovation fundamentally change when you shift from a $60 barrel world to a $30 barrel world?
Well, the interesting thing about natural gas is, unlike something like coal, it can be used for all kinds of things. So not just generating electricity. It can be used in manufacturing. It can be used to make fertilizer. So it actually can be diverted into other sorts of ways to make money. So if you're a natural gas or an oil company, you've actually got some options when the price does drop.
Jordan Wirfs-Brock and Lee Patterson, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Lee Patterson is a reporter and Jordan Wirfs-Brock is a data journalist with Inside Energy, a public media collaboration funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, focusing on America's energy issues. And while the rig count has dropped just over 53% since this time last year, crude oil production, due to innovation, is still higher than what it was a year ago.
That's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry. ASU will be leading its first NASA mission. The school will build and operate a small spacecraft which will map water ice on the moon's south pole. Craig Hardgrove is a postdoctoral research scientist in ASU's School of Earth and Space Exploration and the principal investigator of the LunaMap mission. And Craig, what exactly are you going to be building?
Yeah, so we're building, it's about the size of a shoebox, a large shoebox. We're going to build the entire spacecraft at Arizona State. We have a whole bunch of instrument partners and other partners that are providing components that are space qualified, and we're going to put all that together and deliver it to NASA, and NASA is going to put it on a rocket, and that will be mounted in between two of the stages on a test flight around the moon. And when it gets very close to the moon, it'll shoot out the CubeSats, these little small shoebox-sized spacecraft, and ours will be one of those. We're going to be carrying some detectors that will map the presence of water ice at the south pole of the moon in what we call permanently shadowed regions. We'll be in orbit for about 2 months making those measurements. Every time we sort of screen past the South Pole, we're going to turn on the detectors, and it'll actually be able to tell some things about where the water is, how much there is, or water ice, really. And we'll also sort of be able to maybe reconstruct some of the geologic history of the moon. So this is going to really answer some fundamental planetary science questions and also address something that NASA refers to as in situ resource utilization, which is really just a fancy term for there might be resources that are useful for exploration and eventual human exploration or even robotic exploration of the solar system, and hydrogen is one of them.
Is that sort of the most utility of knowing this information, of having a sense of how much water ice is at the South Pole of the moon and where it's at?
Yeah, that's really, I mean, the utility, if you want to take the very utilitarian approach, yes, it's for human exploration of the solar system and understanding how many resources are out there. There's really a whole sort of burgeoning industry right now thinking about how do we mine resources in the solar system. And so this is one of the ways that we're going to try to start to address that. But it's not really all just that. There is a fundamental science question here, and that's how did this water ice get there?
How did you fit everything that you need in this craft into what, as you say, is the size of a shoebox?
CubeSats have been around for a while now, around 5 to 10 years, maybe even, you know, a little longer. They were designed originally as student experiments, and CubeSats have kind of been evolving in that realm, and the sort of technology development has gone, you know, for the past 5 to 10 years, and it's proceeded enough now that the scientists are starting to say, okay, I think we can actually start to think about putting an instrument in something that's the size of a CubeSat.
What is the time frame for this? I mean, how long do you expect it to be before you're up in space and getting some information?
Yeah, so the first launch of the SLS rocket is in late 2018, and we hope to be on that rocket. So yeah, we're that's sort of the time frame that we're aiming for, is late July-ish of 2018. But the whole duration of the project is about 5 years. And so, you know, we need time to basically build everything, flight qualify everything, deliver it to NASA, and then ASU will actually be operating the spacecraft from ASU. The data will come back to ASU, we'll process it, analyze it, turn it into maps of the water ice at the South Pole, and then release that to NASA and the public so everybody can see the great data that we acquired.
Do you have a gut feeling as to what you'll find?
I think that we're going to be surprised. We're always surprised with every new NASA mission. I think we find some very surprising result. And so I suspect that just given, you know, the statistics of how many surprises come with NASA missions, that we're going to get at least one surprise out of this one. The current best estimates show that, you know, we could have up to between 40 and 100 weight percent water ice sitting in one of these craters in a very small concentrated area. But the data are also consistent with, you know, something that's maybe only in the hundreds of parts per million spread out across a very large area. So this mission is really getting at more specifically than what's been previously done. Where is that water ice and how much is there? And I think we're going to be surprised. Absolutely hope we see some surprises with this one.
Craig Hardgrove is a postdoctoral research scientist in the School of Earth and Space Exploration at ASU. He's also the principal investigator of the Luna Map mission. Craig, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
One of the best ways we have of finding out about climate change is through historical records, which are locked up inside ice cores. The deeper you drill through old ice, the further back in time you go as it's deposited year after year. It turns out that keeping these samples from defrosting, though, is not an easy engineering challenge. Next year, scientists from around the world will start using a novel solution to keeping glacial ice core samples cold. The BBC's Marnie Chesterton investigates why they'll be shipping ice to Antarctica.
It's a place that almost no one will ever see. So here's Dr. Jérôme Chapelaz from France's National Centre for Scientific Research to describe it.
So let's first get in this cave. I open a huge door made of wood, very heavy, and then I get in this huge dome. On the roof of this dome, I see a lot of snow crystals and ice crystals. And then there is not a lot of light because we don't want to bring heat in this place, and the light would bring heat. So then I see a kind of a tunnel, which is really dark. I barely see inside what's going on. I get in this tunnel, and there I see boxes, wooden boxes, cardboard boxes. I take one of these boxes. They weigh something like 80 kilos, so it takes some energy to move them around. I open it, and here we go. Inside, I see these beautiful pieces of ice.
But why would Jérôme Chapelaz want to take ice to the South Pole? On a hot summer's day, I went to the British Antarctic Survey's Ice Core Lab in Cambridge, England, to find out more about this area of research. Emily Ludlow is laboratory manager and kitted me out in furry boots, hat, gloves, and full body suit ready for their freezer room.
We're in the minus 25 cold room, which the ice core group uses at Bass, and we are currently in the middle of cutting up full ice cores into sections ready for analysis. We've got about 30 full ice cores in this room at the moment. This is just a very, very small amount of boxes compared to what we have stored off-site. We can only bring about 12 boxes at a time back to Cambridge ready for analysis because we don't have the physical space to store the boxes and to work on them at the same time.
In this freezer, Dr. Rob Mulvaney is cutting and analysing sections of ice core, each roughly the size of a cricket bat. Ice cores contain more than just water, air bubbles and differing isotopes of chemicals offer information about temperature and atmospheric conditions on this planet going back 800,000 years. But to be of use, they have to have been kept in pristine frozen condition.
There's always a bit of a worry with these long-term storage that you might lose the cause in electrical failure. And in my career, I have once come in on a Monday morning, opened up my cold room and had a small flood of water come out of the cold room because it's failed completely over the weekend. So it's a big worry about losing ice. So if we really want to archive some ice for, you know, 20 or 30 years hence, one of the techniques that the French have come up with is why not ship them to Antarctica?
Dr. Chapelaz explains why the ice moving project is prompted by more than just fear of electrical failure. It's a race against time as the mountain glaciers they work on are beginning to melt.
We are probably the only scientists working on archive of climate and environmental conditions, seeing part of this archive under threat because of global warming. At some point, the mountain glaciers will go away. But even before that, they will experience systematic summer melting, and then this meltwater percolates, goes through depth into the deeper fern, and disturbs all the geochemical records. So once this step is reached, the glacier is basically useless for ice core science, and that's really a problem for us.
Back in Cambridge, the British Antarctic Survey team keep their ice cores much closer to hand, in a less glamorous setting. Emily Ludlow again.
The majority of our ice cores are actually kept in an off-site commercial storage facility, which also stores frozen chicken, frozen peas and ice cream. So you've got valuable ice cores along with everyday commercial food.
A commercial freezer is surely less effort than shipping ice to the South Pole. And the ice is easier to access for scientific study. Yes, but for Dr. Chapelaz, this ice vault provides long-term advantages.
On a scale of a few years, no doubt that the commercial freezer would be very safe. On a scale of decades to centuries, I have very big doubt. Who can guarantee that the commercial freezer will still be working? Who can guarantee that there will not be an economical crisis, a war? So we have to go the safest way.
That was Jerome Chapelaz ending that report from the BBC's Marnie Chesterton. It's the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
I'm Mike Wallach. I'm with Chandler Symphony. I'm the orchestra manager, and I also play percussion. We're a community orchestra. You know, we have music teachers, we have retired people, we have doctors, we have lawyers. How I got here? I brought my daughter to play cello. They needed another person to play cymbals. Here I've been ever since, for 17 years later. My daughter's grown up, gone on, got married, and I'm still here. When we all start to gel together as a group, that's absolutely a fantastic feeling. You come out of the concert and it's just like you don't want to stop playing.
That was Mike Wallach on percussion. He plays with the all-volunteer Chandler Symphony Orchestra. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix, or frankly just think we need some more fine-tuning, just send us a note at the show at kjzz.org. Coming up, a chef who fled New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. He was among the first to see his neighborhood after the storm.
It was so quiet. It was no bird, it was no nothing, like a no man's land, like an atomic bomb, you know, and everything is dead.
He's now made a home in the desert Southwest. His story is just ahead. It's the show. Good afternoon, I'm Mark Brody. This is the show on KJZZ. In Valley traffic on I-10 westbound, the exit ramp at 7th Street is restricted. Look for partly cloudy skies across the valley for the rest of the afternoon with a forecast high of 108. That would be 4 degrees warmer than average. Partly cloudy skies on the way for tonight. Slight chance of storms. Overnight lows in the mid to upper 80s. Mostly sunny skies tomorrow with a high of 109. Right now in Phoenix, with relative humidity of 20%, under cloudy skies, it's 106 degrees at KJZZ at 2:35.
KJZZ is supported by the Grand Canyon Music Festival, three weekends through September 12th at Grand Canyon's South Rim. The Catalyst String Quartet, Sweet Plantain, Brooke Speltz, and the Bonfilio Group. GrandCanyonMusicFest.org.
News headlines.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. President Obama is calling on Congress to move quickly to pass a new federal budget when lawmakers return from their summer recess in early September. They'll have less than a month to do so before the government runs out of money. Obama says his message is clear.
Pass a budget, prevent a shutdown, don't wait till the last minute, don't worry our businesses or our workers by contributing unnecessarily to global uncertainty.
Obama speaking in New Orleans, where he has been marking the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina today. Republican leaders in the House and Senate believe government shutdowns hurt the GOP, but some of the party's presidential candidates say they may use the budget deadline to push for policy changes. The National Weather Service says increasing winds in Washington state later today could spread the flames of the largest of the wildfires burning there. The blaze has burned at least 40 homes and spread over 450 square miles. Gary Roberts, a county emergency manager, says smoke from the blaze is also causing problems.
We've seen a rise in folks coming to the hospitals with respiratory issues. We've given out over 40,000 masks. We've got more coming.
Washington Governor Jay Inslee visited with firefighters on the front lines today. Stocks have extended their rally on Wall Street, with the Dow Jones Industrial Average gaining 369 points today. NPR's Chris Arnold says investors found encouragement in some positive economic data.
Well, for one thing, we got new numbers showing that the U.S. economy expanded at a 3.7% annual rate in the second quarter. That was much stronger than expected, so that surprised people to the upside. There were also upward revisions in consumer spending and business spending. All of that bodes well for the U.S. economy. And the big sell-off in stocks, remember, was sparked by fears about a slowdown in China. But both Asian and European stocks were up today, too.
That's NPR's Chris Arnold. And this is NPR News from Washington.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. Demolition crews have started tearing into nearly 200 vacant homes, clearing the way for the expansion of the South Mountain Freeway, Loop 202. Arizona Department of Transportation officials demolished the first house shortly after 7 this morning. Workers spent the day yesterday salvaging some materials from the properties, which are owned by the state. ADOT has spent the last 20 years acquiring the properties, which include homes, businesses, and industrial sites, ahead of construction that'll start next year. The Loop 202 South Mountain Freeway is the final piece left in the Loop 202 system, linking East and West Valley suburbs. Border agents say they've rescued more than 500 people in the southern Arizona desert since October of last year. Adrienne Crowley works for the Border Patrol. She says two more were saved after locating one of 32 rescue beacons that have been placed in the desert southwest of Tucson.
A lot of these people, they're not really prepared to be crossing through the desert. They run out of water. They need medical help. Groups will leave them behind. So we have the rescue beacons deployed, and you can see the blue light of life for miles.
46 people have died in the desert since last October. This is KJZZ. You're listening to the show, a curated hour of local, national, and international news. I'm Mark Brody, along with the takeaways, Todd Zwillick.
We go down to Washington State, where the Okanagan Complex of Fires has erupted into the biggest wildfire in that state's history. Nearly 300,000 acres across the state are believed to be burning, including farm and ranch land that are home to thousands of animals, crops, and livelihood of the people that work the land as well. Even with more than 1,700 firefighters and crews battling the blaze, the Okanagan complex is just 17% contained at this point. For more on the latest, we spoke with Anna King. She's correspondent for the Northwest News Network from the city of Twisp in Okanagan County.
The conditions on the fire have calmed in the last day or so. There's been a little bit less wind, so firefighters have been able to make some good progress in certain areas. But a lot of these fires are still very much not contained. And the firefighters are working on multiple fronts, and the fire is kind of moving in fingers across the landscape. So the surface area of these fire fronts and the valleys and the steep terrain that it gets into is really hard to fight. There's not just one line that walks forward. It's kind of like a hand into the landscape. And so there's multiple fire angles, and the wind as it changes moves that fire line dramatically back and forth over lines that they thought they had established. So it's very complex.
And you've been talking to firefighters out there on the line about the challenges of battling these blazes in that terrain. What are they telling you?
Yeah, for instance, this man named Lieutenant Kurt Stitch, you know, he's a part of a fire and rescue team, and he talked to me on the south side of Lake Chelan in an area that's burning very near to homes. He told me that the crew had to look out for boulders on the fire line.
As the fire burns, the things that hold a lot of those rocks that have been sitting up there for years, as those disappear, those rocks are coming down. I mean, we're seeing 100, 200, 300-pound rocks coming rolling down the hill. We have that, rattlesnakes, and all the kinds of the other things that are up here. Bees are another big issue right now. A number of our guys have been stung multiple times.
Anna King, there's also the huge challenge of livestock farm animals in the area. I mentioned earlier there's a great deal of farm and ranch land around here.
Yeah, in fact, just yesterday I was up into some active fire with a rancher in his pickup. We were going up some really rough roads and into some areas that frankly made me really afraid. There was burning trees and burning stumps just right along the roadway as we passed in the pickup, and it was burning across the road in several places. We were going to check on his cattle, which are up in some of these high mountain meadows, and it's really pretty scary for these guys. These are millions of dollars of cattle and genetics, bloodlines that they've worked on for generations that are up here in these fires, and there's no place to put them that's safe. He said, I could walk these cows all downhill, but then I'd have to risk my granddaughters and my grandsons and everybody on horseback to get them out of here. And he said, you know, these cattle are worth a lot, but they're not worth my family.
You also spent a little bit of time with a horse rancher?
I did. You know, in fact, these horse ranchers were having to evacuate their animals, not only because of the threat of fire, which was all around them when they came out, but the air quality is so poor that some of these horses are developing asthma kind of conditions. And they're athletes. You know, these are horses that you see in the Olympics. And in fact, I talked to one gal, Tuli Bodishilich, who told me that she helped evacuate in the caravan 15 horses and five trucks and trailers out of the burning landscape just last week.
Definitely shocking. I mean, once we got all the horses loaded up and headed out, we headed down valley, and I mean, it was dark at that point, so you can basically only see the fire, and that's all pretty shocking.
Anna King, before we let you go, they've imported firefighters and administrators from places as far away as Australia. What are the experts saying about the prospects this week for starting to contain the Okanagan complex?
I think that the locals who know this country are telling me this is going to be burning until the snow flies. So we're talking about, you know, late October, November, December. So the fire officials are hoping for a little bit of help from some possible rains this weekend. But if that brings wind and not rain, we could really see the fire grow.
Anna King, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Anna King is correspondent for the Northwest News Network.
That's the Takeaways, Todd Zwillick. Anyone who's flown know what it sounds like inside an airplane, but new research suggests that noise combined with exposure to jet fuels could cause hearing and cognitive problems. O'Neill Guthrie is an assistant professor and audiologist at NAU and has been studying those effects in rats.
The U.S. Air Force was interested in the effects of jet fuel on the sensory cells in the inner ear. These are the cells that allow us to detect sounds. Therefore, we conducted a series of experiments to study these sensory cells, but we evaluated low levels of multiple jet fuel exposures. We found that the structure and function of these sensory cells in the inner ear were normal. We also found that the eighth craniofacial nerve, the nerve that connects the ear to the brain, was able to transmit sound to the brain in a normal manner. But as the sound entered the brainstem, there was a significant impairment in the way the brainstem processed the sound. The combined results suggest that a person suffering from the effects of jet fuel exposure might be able to detect sounds or communication signals quite well, but might not be able to properly process the information.
What struck me as kind of interesting was that when you think about the problems people might have with their hearing when it relates to jets, you'd think about the noise, not necessarily the fuel that the jets are using. But this research seems to suggest that the fuels, in addition to the noise, might be causing some of those hearing problems.
Exactly right. And it's the particular type of hearing problem is not in detecting the sound, but in processing the sound, so making sense of the sound.
But when you combine that with the problems that people encounter hearing from being exposed to the noise of the jets, is that worse than sort of just what we maybe just thought of when they were just hearing them?
Exactly. So now you have double problems, right? One is you actually have a physical hearing loss, and the other is you have this dysfunction where the brain is not processing whatever distorted information does get to the brain.
Do you sense that these results will mean the most to folks who work, you know, airplane mechanics or folks who work on the tarmac at airports or folks who work in the Air Force or other branches of the military with planes?
Yes, that's exactly right. These are the folks that are directly at risk. But the public at large is also at risk because when we travel on commercial jets, we are at risk at inhaling those fuels.
From inside the plane?
From inside the plane. So you may have had that experience as well, where you're sitting in the plane and they're fueling while you're on the tarmac and you smell the fumes. That has happened to me on several occasions. So it's not just relevant to military, but the public at large.
What is the potential damage? I mean, if you just fly in a commercial airline every so often, but you don't actually work at an airport, you're not a baggage handler, you're not an airplane mechanic, is this a realistic concern that frequent flyers should be worried about potentially losing their hearing and their cognitive functions as it relates to hearing?
We don't exactly know that yet because the research is just beginning. But when you combine low-level exposure to fuels with noise exposure, which is in our everyday environment, there might be a synergistic effect where a person becomes even more susceptible.
O'Neill Guthrie is an assistant professor, audiologist, and principal investigator at Northern Arizona University. Good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ. We're bringing you more of our community mixed with national stories and international news. In Valley traffic, I-10 westbound at 7th Street, the exit ramp there is restricted. Look for partly cloudy skies for the rest of the afternoon with a high of 108 today. We hit 106 yesterday. Partly cloudy skies on the way for tonight. Slight chance of showers. Overnight lows in the upper 80s. Mostly sunny tomorrow with a high of 109. It's 106 degrees at 2:48.
KJZZ is supported by Wagon Wash Healthy Pet Center, enhancing the bond with your pets through healthy products, services, and education. Locations in both Phoenix and Scottsdale. More at wagonwash.com.
Now we bring you the story of a Hurricane Katrina survivor with a happy ending. Terry Marceau was the head pastry chef at the Fairmont, one of New Orleans' oldest hotels. After the storm shut down the hotel and destroyed his home, Marceau left the bayou and moved to the desert. KJZZ's Monica Ortiz Uribe reports from the restaurant he opened in New Mexico.
Hello! How many people?
French cuisine was hard to find in southern New Mexico before Thierry Marceau opened Le Rendezvous 8 years ago in Las Cruces. On a weekday at lunch, the place is packed.
Bonjour, Simone. Comment ça va?
As is his custom, Marceau wanders the dining area in a black chef's uniform and greets his customers. Simone Kaufman is halfway through a plate of beef bourguignon, but her thoughts are already on dessert.
I just came back from France.
The pastry smells the same way, looks the same way, and tastes the same way. So that's good.
Marceau grew up in his father's bakery, which was in a ski resort in the southern French Alps. As a teenager, Marceau spent winters on the slopes and summers in front of an oven, training to become a pastry chef. When he finished school, a friend told him he could find work in the United States. That's how he ended up in New Orleans.
We arrived in New Orleans. It was Mardi Gras week. I feel like it was in a Disneyland here, you know? I mean, people on the street, you know, drinking.
Eventually, Marceau ended up as the head pastry chef at the historic Fairmont, known today as the Roosevelt Hotel. The century-old landmark has hosted the likes of Elvis Presley and a handful of U.S. presidents. In 2005, it got a visit from Hurricane Katrina. Marceau recalls 800 people decided to ride out the storm in the hotel.
So I decided to bake pretty much everything I have in my fridge, you know. Mostly cookies, brownies, you know, stuff who have a chef life, you know. I'm not going to bake cream puff, okay?
Marceau also sent up hundreds of chocolate truffles to the guest rooms. It made for a festive mood in the hours before the storm hit. Overnight, the staff drank champagne at the hotel bar. But the party ended when the levees broke and the hotel basement flooded.
The whole heart of the hotel was in the basement. The hotel was dead after that, you know, no more air condition, no more nothing.
Outside the hotel, the floodwaters rose between 1 and 2 feet, enough to strand almost everyone inside. Marceau says some of the wealthier guests used their cell phones to call a private helicopter service that could pick them up.
It was getting so stressful, some guests, you know, they would pay anything to get out of there.
The hotel began to evacuate the remaining guests and staff 2 days after the storm. Marceau came back 2 weeks later and visited his home for the first time. What he saw was shocking.
There was no life around. I opened the door, it was so quiet. It was no bird, it was no nothing, like a no man's land, like an atomic bomb, you know, and everything is dead.
That was the end of Marceau's life in New Orleans. A decade later, he's found refuge in an unlikely place.
Are the French fries coming?
His restaurant is in a strip mall, across from a Walgreens and a Subway. Not exactly where he imagined himself after working in a five-star hotel. But when he walks from table to table each day, he's rewarded with warm smiles and familiar faces.
This lady over there, she's coming every day at 12 o'clock for the last 7 years. You know, you cherish that. It's something special, you know, and I never feel that before.
In New Orleans, Marceau served his pastries to the Saints football players. In Las Cruces, he makes carrot cake for a pastor's 60th birthday party. He doesn't worry too much when his teenage kids go out with friends. And on Sundays, he plays soccer at a neighborhood park.
For the first time in my life, I feel like I established something here. The life I used to have before and the life I have now is completely different. Maybe it changed my life for the better.
Thank you so much. Enjoy.
Monica Ortiz Uribe, KJZZ News, Las Cruces, New Mexico.
When I was a kid, I rode a horse one time for about an hour, and I basically couldn't walk normally for about a week after that. So it's kind of mind-blowing to think about someone riding hundreds of miles on horseback, much less doing so across Mongolia. That's right, Mongolia. But that's exactly what Michelle Tanaka did. The 25-year-old Tucson native is just back from the Mongol Derby. Michelle, what made you want to do this race?
I had a friend who did it in 2012, and it just was like all my favorite things. It was horses, it was travel, it was adventure. You know, it's got all these unknown elements. You're on these half-wild horses. You kind of, you know, you're in the middle of nowhere. You've got backup support, but you're not really supposed to ever see them. And it's just kind of you and your, you know, series of horses racing across the Mongolian wilderness. I mean, I had to do it.
So tell me about this derby. How long is it? How long did it take you to do? What's it like?
So it's a little bit over 1,000 kilometers, so it's about 620 miles, and you swap horses every 20, 25 miles. So this year's race, I think officially it was 1,003 kilometers, and we all rode 28 horses through the various horse stations. So the horses are half wild, which means in Mongolia, you know, it's a really harsh climate, and horses are, you know, everywhere. So these herders have these herds of horses that really have no human contact for like 11 to 9 months out of the year. They just live in their wild herds, and then they're brought in for riding or racing. But they're a completely different animal from like these westernized domestic horses that, you know, we are all used to. So that really attracted me to the race. So, you know, you show up at a horse station, you select your horse, they're all strung up on a line, and then you ride to the next horse station. You know, you have everything loaded onto your GPS. There's no marked course or anything. And then these Mongolian families host you, and they live in yurts, which are called gers out there, and those serve as the horse stations. So at each station, you know, you get a bite to eat, you pick your next horse, and then off you go.
Once you're out there, is it just you and your horse and your thoughts?
Yeah, pretty much. You, your horse, your GPS. So hopefully, you know, you don't step in a marmot hole and your horse flips and you come off and your horse runs away. And hopefully your horse doesn't buck you off and then ditch you. Yeah, it's quite an adventure. So this year we were allowed 11 days to finish. And I finished early morning on the 8th day.
Was that good for you?
Yeah, that was really good. I came in joint third.
Out of how many racers?
Out of 37.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, I was really proud of myself.
Had you ever done a race anywhere close to this long before?
No, I've never even done like a standard endurance race.
Oh, geez. Wow.
Yeah, nope.
So, I mean, were you nervous about having your first go at something like this in Mongolia for this length?
Definitely. I mean, it's hard enough to do something like that on, you know, on a domestic horse. And then you throw in these Mongolian horses. And yeah, there were quite a few butterflies in my stomach starting out. But it was so, you know, I've been anticipating it for so long and training so hard for so long that I was just mostly I was excited to be there. But yeah, like, you know, before every horse, you just kind of cross your fingers that it's not going to, you know, be a demon and throw you into some rocks and then ditch you 20 miles out from the next station.
I'm sure that's just what every parent wants to hear that their child is doing.
Yeah. It's funny. My mother, the day before I left, she wanted to buy me out of it. She's like, I will pay you to just pull out of this race. I will reimburse you all your costs. Just don't do it. And obviously I refused. And then I was very surprised and pleased to find out that, you know, while I was there, she was so into it. She's like, yeah, go. Yeah, so.
Do you plan to do either this race or some race like it again?
Absolutely. It's a very expensive race, so I don't know that I'll be returning to this one for a while. But I definitely would like to go back and do it again. It was just an incredible amount of fun. I don't think I'll be getting into endurance riding, though. Not quite my thing.
Why not?
I would like to have more of the adventure involved in it if I'm going to be in the saddle for that long.
Adventure as far as like where you get to go as opposed to like trying
where you get to go and what you're riding even, you know, getting on a horse that, you know, has been touched 5 times in the last year, you know. It's exciting.
How do you tell if a horse is going to be a good companion for, you know, a couple hundred miles potentially?
For each horse, you know, you're really only going about 25 miles with each horse. So my strategy, the thing with these Mongolian horses is you can't really roll up and look at them and say, oh, that one's a racehorse or that one's not, based on their physiques. I got on one fat little pony that just, you know, he looked like a little child's pony. He was adorable and I could not stop him. He just took off with me. And I went into the race knowing that, you know, nobody can tell. So my strategy was actually just to ask the Mongolian herders. One of my very few phrases in Mongolia is "Hamgi Sam Muruguch," which means "Give me your best racehorse." So I'd get to a horse station and then tell the herders that, and then they would give me, you know, their best racehorse. And so I think that contributed to me not coming off my horse a single time during the whole race.
Nice.
I got nice horses to ride.
Michelle Tanaka is just back from competing in the Mongol Derby in obviously Mongolia. Michelle, welcome back. Congratulations and thanks for talking.
Thank you.
Be sure to be with us tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock for the show. Do concussions affect men and women differently? And we'll talk to the brothers behind a new movie shot on the Gila River Indian community. Those stories and a whole lot more tomorrow afternoon at 2 on the show. The show is produced by our senior producer, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Anika Klein, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Regina Revazova, and Tiara Vian. Tracy Greer and Sky Shout are the digital team. Our news director is Al Macias. Our executive producer is John Hoban. We always want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know about good story ideas. You can email us at theshow@kjzz.org. Also, be sure to get the KJZZ mobile app. You can podcast the entire show. I'm Mark Brody. This is member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. All Things Considered is next. Thank you so much for listening. It's 3 o'clock.